Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. I'm your host, Mono. Sakura season is winding down in Tokyo, but we're still getting our dose of pink this week thanks to Kirby. We're doing back-to-back special episodes. Last time was all about racing games and a cool racing arcade hidden in Akiba. This time, we're giving some love to the pink puff himself, Kirby. That's right, a special Kirby episode. If you've got any pink clothing, go ahead and wear it. I'll always beat myself up for not buying that Kirby's Pinball Land shirt the first time I saw it. It was 3,000 yen, which is a bit expensive for a shirt. Next time I saw it, 6,000 yen. Don't make my mistake. I'll be chatting about a trio of Kirby titles. Fellow Tokyo resident Genki will join me to talk Kirby and the Forgotten Land, the newest Kirby adventure on Switch. It's HAL's first foray into 3D platforming, and there's a ton to talk about. I also want to chat about two other Kirby titles available on Switch. Can you guess them? That's right, Kirby's Dream Land 3 and Kirby's Dream Course. Two Super Nintendo titles you can play right now via Nintendo Switch Online. I didn't really have any experience with either of these games until it hit the Switch, so it's definitely fun to look back on and see how Kirby has changed throughout the years. This week's feature is all about Yamashiroya, a toy shop in Ueno, Tokyo. Now, what does that have to do with video games or Kirby? Well, although they sell a lot of items, there is an official Kirby shop inside the store. It's not quite Nintendo Tokyo or Pokemon Center levels in terms of quantity, but it is certainly an amazing sight to behold for Kirby fans. I'll be giving a breakdown on everything you need to check out in the store. After that is a news roundup, and sadly, there is some disappointing news regarding a game that starts with Z and ends with an Elda. But hey, until then, time to grab some sweets and talk Kirby. All right, let's chat games. Kirby and the Forgotten Land, the Pink Puff's first foray into 3D, came to Nintendo Switch a few days ago. It's a game too big for one person, so joining me today is a special guest. So please introduce yourself.
Oh, hi there. I'm Genki. You can find me on Twitter at Genki_JPN. I'm just a gamer living in Japan, in Tokyo. And yeah, I like the Kirby game, this new one.
Thanks a lot for joining me today. So let's establish some street cred first. What's your history with the Kirby franchise?
I haven't played that many Kirby games. I played like the original Kirby's Dream Land. I think it's on Game Boy.
Right.
I played that back in the day. And apart from that, I played the DS one. I think it was Canvas Curse. I played that on the DS also when I was younger. Apart from that, I haven't played that many other Kirby games recently. Since I played the demo of this game, then I got really interested in this Kirby and the Forgotten Land.
My first Kirby game was Kirby's Pinball Land, and I bought Metroid 2 on the same day. So that was a pretty important day for me. So let's peel the Band-Aid off. What are your overall thoughts on Kirby and the Forgotten Land?
Oh, yeah, it's a really great game. It's like so joyful and happy and cute. And it's just a really nice experience. Like, you can't help but smile when you're playing the game. It's just a really, really joyful and happy game. It's not like the most like technical, difficult or anything like that. But it's just like a nice experience. Enjoy it. And like a nice and a joyful experience to have.
I also thought the game was absolutely fantastic. I felt like it got stronger as it went along. The first world was fine, but I wasn't really feeling it was a drastic leap in compared to the past Kirby games. But levels get much more unpredictable and creative as the game progresses. Did you have a favorite world?
Yes, I thought that too. I really enjoyed the first world, like a post-apocalypse city. And then maybe, I don't like water worlds, so I wouldn't say that one. But I did like the lava levels as well. Towards the end, the lava. It had some cool mechanics. How about you?
The theme park world was probably my favorite. And the ice world is like really unorthodox. I've been playing Elden Ring, and it definitely felt like this is what would happen if HAL made a Souls game. And
oh, yeah.
Robobot also had a lot of creative levels, like an ice cream factory and a casino. So I'm glad HAL is being very bold when it comes to level theming.
Yeah, especially the when you fight the Dedede at the last boss in the Ice World.
Oh, yes.
That's very Souls.
Yeah, that felt like straight out of Souls. I'm surprised nobody on Twitter has put like some Souls music under that boss fight, but I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
Yeah, you should do that.
So how did you feel about Kirby transitioning into 3D? Do you feel like it's faithful to the 2D titles, or is the flow of a level different from what you expected?
Yeah, I think they got the chance to try something very new and experiment. Like the basics are all the same, really, like the powers. They're quite similar to the old Kirby games, but just that you can move in 3D, the different types of levels, it's like they created something new and really interesting. So I think it's the best evolution of the series.
Mm.
Kind of similar to 2D Mario and 3D Mario.
Yeah, the game is more in line with, I would say, 3D World than, say, Mario Odyssey. Levels are linear, but they still have quite an emphasis on explorations and secrets. One thing I noticed is that the enemies are more spread out than usual. I always say that the 2D Kirby's are more action games than anything else because you are really just going through the levels, obliterating enemies with amazing powers. But here, they definitely gave players more space to move around. What do you think about how the levels are laid out?
Oh, yeah, I really like the way the levels are laid out. Like, there's a lot of room to explore little secrets, even though it's very linear. Like, you're going down the path, and many times you can't, like, backtrack. But within those levels, there's a lot of space to, like, explore different areas and find little secrets and little extra coins or, like, the gacha toys. Yeah, I think they really did well with the level design.
So what did you think of Mouthful Mode?
Oh, Mouthful Mode, that's like the best part of the game, right? That's like the most creative new thing that they've added to this new Kirby game.
Mm.
So yeah, that's that just brings joy to everyone who plays it. Yeah, so that mode was really, really good. I really love the different ways they were so inventive and imaginative in creating new ways Kirby can transform into random objects.
Yeah, I thought it was a great way to keep levels fresh, and there's a good balance between the action ones and the puzzle ones. Do you have a favorite Mouthful Mode ability?
The favorite one, I'd say the cone one is pretty funny.
Right.
The cone one and the car one.
Right.
Those are my two favorite ones. Like cone one is like just the shape of it and the way he waddles, and then you can smash, so it's quite strong as well. So I like the versatility of the cone.
I think the car is a lot of people's favorites, and it was awesome. But I really like the water balloon one, suck up a lot of water. And also the light bulb, because there were some fun puzzles surrounding them. And I was pretty impressed by the lighting when you use the light bulb in dark areas. It kind of reminded me of Luigi's Mansion 3 a bit.
Yes. That with the torch, right? And you're flashing the ghosts.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah. I didn't like the torch thing because, like, you couldn't really kill people with it. Like,
right.
You can't really hit enemies with it. That was just a bit frustrating. But yeah, the lighting was really cool. But yeah, all really creative. I think all the Mouthful modes. I really like the circle one as well. And when you're doing the shapes, the shapes to the holes. That was like really creative. Yeah. I really like that. That was really fun.
So that's the new ability, but Kirby also has his traditional copy abilities. Did any copy abilities stand out to you this time around?
They're all really good. And like, I'm not sure if you had such evolutions in the previous Kirby games.
No, this is new for this one.
Yeah, so like, just seeing the different evolutions is such a surprise, like what you're going to get, what it's going to become. It's like, it's super crazy, the abilities. So my favorite one was, I like the gun one, like the shoot, the ranger ability. And the way it evolves, it's really interesting. It's like he becomes like a pirate with these two, like these pirate guns. And then it becomes like, oh, I don't want to spoil it, but it becomes like even more interesting every time you evolve it. And it's just really creative and fun to see what these abilities evolve into. Yeah, that was really enjoyable for me.
I thought the homing bombs were pretty useful, and I also like the pencil drill, because the pencils actually have multiple patterns. Every time you use a pencil, it changes the pattern, which is a lot of fun. This game actually has, I would say, fewer abilities than the past games, but they're offset by the upgrades. So did you think the upgrade was implemented well, or would you have preferred more different abilities?
I think the upgrade system is better because with the mouthful mode already, you have a lot of different abilities. If you had just more abilities instead of upgrades, I think it would be too much. It would be a bit too overwhelming in terms of choice because they already have the mouthful mode stuff as well, which is like separate ability in itself. So I think the evolution is the best way. And it kind of makes it like a bit like Pokemon, you know.
These
abilities evolve into newer, stronger abilities. And that also makes like going back into the levels and trying to get the things to evolve and develop your abilities even more interesting. So it adds like an RPG element to it. So I think that was a good choice.
What did you think of the secret missions in each level?
Oh yeah, they were quite cool. Some of them were a bit like random, but
right.
I think they were quite fun to do, to find out what you had to do. Some of them were not that interesting, like take down the posters or like
right.
Hit posters off the wall. But some of them were a bit more creative, like the ones where you have to like save the little ducklings.
Yes, yes.
Those little things like that. They had some creative ones there, which were really fun.
I would say in the first world, you can find all of them easily by accident, but later on, they definitely get more obscure and difficult to find. They hide what the missions are. Did you like that it was hidden the first time, or would you have preferred to know it going in?
I guess it's difficult. I guess it's better that they don't. It's a surprise. Mm. It like gives you like a reason to play it again. But I wish like after you just do it once, they would tell you all of them. Not like it's like if once you figure out one, then they'll let you, they'll give you the next one. But they won't just give you all of them after you've done the level once. So maybe I'd prefer if once you've done level once, they just give you all of them after that.
Yeah, that's true. I do like that they kind of did hide them the first time, because if they did show it to all of us, I think a lot of people would just try to 100% it the first time around. And it would probably throw off the pacing of like the level.
I agree.
Another big addition are the treasure roads, which are specific challenges where you have a copy ability and need to clear a course in a set amount of time. What did you think of this addition?
Yeah, they were really fun. They're adding new elements, like new gameplay elements to the game. I thought they were really fun, like the little side time trials. And they kind of extend the gameplay of the game. And I also like how in the map there was like hidden areas that you could go to on the map, and you could unlock new time trials for like mouthful mode abilities or other abilities. So you could also like the map was like not just a map, it was like kind of interactive. You could find coins and other time trials in the map. I thought that was really creative as well. But yeah, they were really good, the time trials. I have to get the better times. I think I got like the top time in like only a handful of them.
I'm still stuck on one of the earlier stairs puzzle ones. That's the 3-star stairs one. That one is really tough.
Oh, I haven't tried that one yet. I should try it.
It's one of those where like you know what to do, but the time is kind of a big issue.
Yeah. Yeah, the 3-star ones are definitely challenging. Not for kids.
Right. This game also has a town building feature in Waddle Dee Town. I felt like it really helped the pacing of the game, since after every world there is some notable addition to the town. What did you think about Waddle Dee Town?
Waddle Dee Town was awesome. It's so cute. It's like so much cuteness and joy comes out of that little town. And it evolves as you play the game. And you can do little mini games in it. And just seeing the little animations of the different Waddle Dees and interacting with them, like the ones in the coffee shop or at the cafe, or like the ones that's like talking or lying around the town. It's really awesome and cute. I really like that addition.
Yeah, and there are a lot of mini games inside the town, like the cafe one and fishing, and also one that's really inspired by Tilt and Tumble. In the past Kirby games, they had like more involved side games that were kind of separated from the main game, but now those have been replaced by these mini games. Which do you prefer, like kind of the more separated games, or do you like the mini games that are more integrated into the main story?
Maybe I prefer the separated ones, maybe because they're more like... they're more specific to just that mode, and they're not like integrated into the town or the single player story. But yeah, because these mini games, they were fun, but they're really brief.
Right.
They're like, they're really, or once you've finished them all, like, there's not much reason to go back to them. I like the like the fishing one was really fun, and the tilt and tumble game was fun as well.
Yeah, I'm a big tilt and tumble fan, so any way they could bring it back just gets me excited. So I'm happy it was in here at least a little bit.
Which do you prefer? Which style?
I kind of like how you got coins for the mini games because you could use it for the upgrades. Early on, you pretty much could get any upgrade you wanted as soon as you got it. But later on in the game, it does become a bit more difficult. You kind of have to pick which ones you want to upgrade first because of the lack of coins and star coins. And also, I've spent a lot of my coins on the gacha machine, getting all the Kirby figures. So I think that definitely impeded my upgrade abilities. I do kind of wonder because in the past games, like HAL would take those like mini games and they would expand it into like bigger games, especially on the 3DS. So I'm kind of wondering like, oh, are they going to do these sort of smaller Kirby games based on the mini games in Forgotten Land or maybe do something different? Genki, have you made any progress in the post game yet?
A little bit. I've started the new, the new dimension of the new universe, but I've only got maybe the first two or three levels. I haven't got to the end. It's cool that they have quite a lot of post-game elements, not only the time trials and trying to upgrade all the abilities. They have this post-game world that you could also do where it's like more challenging versions of the original levels. It's quite cool.
Yeah, I dipped a bit into that. They are kind of interesting kind of remixes of the existing game, but they don't feel like the exact same. I think they've done a good job making it feel like background is similar, but what you're actually doing is quite different.
Yeah, it's a lot more challenging. Like you can, the difficulty level definitely steps up, and they put more enemies in the levels. It's really cool, a post-game mode.
So what would you like to see in a future 3D Kirby title?
Yeah, I'm a really big fan of Mario Odyssey. So if they could make it like more ambitious like that, that would be awesome. I think they could do like the Mario approach where you have your 2D Marios and your 3D Marios. So they could have the 2D Kirby's and 3D Kirby's, and they could build the franchise like that. But yeah, if they did the Mario Odyssey style, I think that would be really good. Like just expand the quality and the levels, make it more like open, like Mario Odyssey. That would be cool.
Yeah, I think definitely HAL will want to experiment more with the 3D games. I think they can get a lot of mileage out of this kind of more 3D world structure, but I definitely would love to see them do bigger hub areas like in Mario Odyssey. But we might be, 10 years away from that, but we'll see.
Might be a while away.
So Genki, do you have any final thoughts on Kirby and the Forgotten Land?
I think this game has made me into a big Kirby fan. From the moment I played the demo, which is like at the beginning of March, I was like, wow, this is something special. And since then, I've been a Kirby stan. So like, if you follow my Twitter, I've got lots of Kirby posts. So yeah, I think I'm a true Kirby fan from now on, thanks to this game.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Genki. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter is Genki, GENKI_JPN. You can find me on Twitter. I post about a bit similar to yourself, photos around Tokyo to do with games and just gaming takes from Japan.
All right, great. And I'll link it into the podcast description. Genki, once again, thank you for joining me.
Thanks. That was fun.
Big thanks to Genki for joining me to chat about Kirby and the Forgotten Land. Be sure to follow him on Twitter. I've linked to his profile in the podcast description. So, Kirby and the Forgotten Land is Kirby's grandest, most epic adventure yet. But let's go back a bit, all the way back to the SNES era, although you could say this is really during the N64's heyday. I want to talk a bit about Kirby's Dream Land 3. Here's a game I never touched until it came to the SNES app on Nintendo Switch Online. I know a lot of people jumped into Link to the Past or Super Metroid, but I already played those. I was far more interested in my gaming gaps. Titles I've never played, like Dream Land 3. It was the first game I really focused on when the SNES games came to Switch. It's a pretty unusual, if not forgotten, game. More forgotten than the Forgotten Land. It is a sequel to Dream Land 1 and 2, which were Game Boy titles. So this is the console debut for the Dream Land series, which is sort of the main series, but Kirby's Adventure isn't exactly a spin-off. The naming is weird, so let's just accept that. It came out on SNES in 1997. Now think back to what consoles were out in 1997. The PlayStation. The Nintendo 64. Sega Dreamcast was a year away in Japan. So this is a very late release SNES title, and the last one published by Nintendo in America. Kirby does have that reputation of coming out on the tail end of a Nintendo's console lifespan. The remake of Kirby's Star Stacker for the SNES actually came out in 1999. What's even crazier is that it came out in 1997 in North America, but 1998 in Japan, with about a 4-month gap in between the titles. Why, I have no idea, but it was something that happened every now and then back in the day. This game was developed by HAL in Japan, so you'd think that would get priority. Oh, and by the way, HAL is a Tokyo-based developer, but they do have a Yamanashi studio, and Yamanashi is most famous for the home of Mount Fuji, which is why you see a lot of Fuji iconography in HAL games. Kirby's Dream Land 3 is the second entry in the unofficial Dark Matter trilogy, named after the villain that appears in these titles. The trilogy consists of Kirby's Dream Land 2, Dream Land 3, and Kirby 64. All these games are directed by Shinichi Shimomura, who also worked on Sakurai-led Kirby titles. There is quite a cult following around him on the internet, since there isn't a whole lot of information online about him, and his last credit is on Kirby Nightmare in Dream Land from 2002. So, what happened after that? Did he leave HAL? If so, where did he go? How could the director of several Nintendo-published games just disappear and have zero game credits for 2 decades? Mr. Shimomura, if you are listening to this podcast, I would love to have you on as a guest. Tweet at me. You essentially have 2 branches of Kirby Adventure games in the 90s. Those directed by Sakurai and those directed by Shimomura. The Sakurai ones are obviously the more breakout hits. Dream Land, Adventure, Superstar, these are classic games in the Nintendo canon. Dream Land 2, 3, 64, not so much, although I do like all of these games, especially 64. And even though all these are 2D platformers, the Sakurai titles and the Shimomura titles are quite different. Sakurai games are more fast-paced and action-oriented, while Shimomura's titles are a bit slower and have more puzzle-solving and secrets. And within Shimomura's Dark Matter trilogy, Dream Land 3 is perhaps the least discussed. Dream Land 2 stood out for introducing the classic animal characters that you can ride. Kirby 64 brought Kirby into faux 3D, and it had awesome dual copy abilities. What does Dream Land 3 have? Well, more animal friends. It is certainly more iterative than most Kirby titles, as it doesn't introduce any huge new gameplay feature. I think this, along with it being a 1997 SNES title, certainly hurt its perception and legacy, but I do think it's an overall fun game and an interesting entry in the Kirby canon. The first thing most will notice is the art style. It's heavy on the pastel colors, like it was drawn with crayon. You might be thinking Yoshi's Island, but it looks a lot different from that, even though it is a similar idea. The colors are far more muted and less vibrant here, and it often looks like it's hand-drawn. Dream Land 3 does look different for a Kirby game, and really for a Nintendo game in general. The animal friends are back from Dream Land 2, and some new ones join in as well. There's Nago, which is a big bipedal cat, Choo Choo, which is a female slime, think of a girl Gooey, and Pitch, who is a tiny bird. Nago and Pitch are similar to Rick and Kine on the surface, but they do have some unique abilities. Like in Dream Land 2, a big part of the gameplay is merging copy abilities with your animal buddy. The ice copy ability with Rick will give you a completely different attack than the ice ability with Choo Choo. Many of these are fun to use, with well-made and very silly animations. Most of the animals from Dream Land 2 have the exact same moveset here, so I think for Dream Land veterans, it's a bit been there done that. The new buddies have more creative powers, especially Pitch. There's one where you control Pitch like a RC plane, one where you use him as a golf ball. The copy ability combo was perfected in Kirby 64, but you can see them being experimental with the idea here. Also, where's Nago? I am so surprised that he's not a more popular character. I mean, he's a cat. His abilities are pretty funny, since he's basically wielding Kirby like a weapon and throwing him about. Since Dream Land 3, Nago has only appeared in very minor cameos. Even in Star Allies, that brought back a ton of characters, he only appears briefly and is not playable. Hal is really losing money by not slapping him on literally everything. A couple of other notable characters made their debut in this game. Adeline, who more famously pops up in 64, shows up here, matching the painterly aesthetic. Actually, there is some controversy regarding whether this character is the same as the one in 64, since she's called Ado here. But since she looks exactly the same, so let's just combine them. Gooey debuted in Dream Land 2, but he has a much more prominent role here, serving as the co-op partner. You can actually cheese the game a bit by summoning him, then swallowing him up for a health boost. Another memorable character for me is Pick, who is Rick the Hamster's girlfriend. Again, where is she? The final boss is Zero, which is a creepy form of dark matter. It's a classic example of Kirby having horrifying final bosses, although O2 in 64 is much creepier. The levels are your typical Kirby affair. You go to the right, you attack enemies, you enter a door every now and then. The levels are less compact than a Sakurai game, which leads to them being a bit slower paced and less action-oriented. In lieu of that, there are more areas to explore and puzzles to solve. All of Shimomura's games rely heavily on earning collectibles to get the quote-unquote real ending. Dream Land 3's main collectible are the Heart Stars. Now, this is not something you just pick up during the level. It's typically rewarded to you by solving a special puzzle inside the level. These Heart Star challenges are very diverse. A level might have you avoid stepping on tulips to get one, another might challenge you to a quiz hosted by a mini-boss, or collect 5 pieces of an object. These Heart Star challenges are easily the most distinct element of each level. It can also be the most frustrating. This game doesn't tell you what the challenge is. Instead, it will show you a character that the challenge relates to. For the tulip challenge, where you aren't supposed to stomp on the flowers, it will show a flower. Okay, how am I supposed to guess what to do through that? There's actually a challenge where you have to step on all the flowers. I really don't think it would have hurt the game if they just directly told us the challenge with a single sentence as the level starts. One fun aspect of the Heart Stars is that they often feature guest characters from other Nintendo games, the most famous being Samus from Metroid. There is actually a stage where you need to fight Metroids and then Samus will reward you with a Heart Star. What a crossover. Sadly, you don't really see these mix-ups anymore outside of Smash Bros. Other guest characters include the robot Rob, Hikari and Donbei from Shin Onigashima, plus Chao and Goku from Yu Yuki. It's pretty funny to see all these obscure characters who have never had their games released in America show up as cameos in this one. And hey, this is a few years before Smash Bros. I've always said that Smash is just a spin-off of Kirby Superstar, and I've yet to be proven wrong. Many are likely turned off by the obscure puzzles, slower-paced levels, and lack of innovation from the previous Dream Land titles. And all these are pretty valid points. If you didn't like Dream Land 1 or 2, I don't see you enjoying this title. I would say Dream Land 2 is my favorite of the series, but I do think there is a lot to like about this game. The graphics, the animal friends, and the creativity of some of the Heart Star challenges make it stand out in the Kirby canon. It's on NSO now, so if you have the time, well, try it out. We're going to wrap up the game talk with another SNES Kirby title, Kirby's Dream Course. Kirby is no stranger to spin-offs. In fact, I would say the series is practically defined by them. Puzzle, action, racing, sports, you name it, Kirby has done it. When you think of a spin-off, you think of a title that's pawned off to another company while the developers make another entry in the main series. Not here, not with Kirby. 1994's Kirby's Dream Course was developed by HAL and Nintendo EAD proper. Imagine if the Nintendo EPD team today made Mario Golf, for example. That would be pretty crazy. But at this time, Kirby was gaining a lot of momentum and HAL had plenty of ideas for the Pink Puff. Again, I cannot stress this enough. Kirby is round. The roundest thing you've ever seen. And because of this, he is ripe to be shoved into a variety of games. Does your game have a ball in it? Well, what if the ball was Kirby? That thought alone has brought in millions of dollars. Kirby's Dream Course is actually the first Kirby game released on the SNES, and the fourth one overall. It went platformer, platformer, pinball, golf. I dare you to tell me another franchise with that strange of a trajectory. Kirby's Dream Course is a Kirby-fied version of golf, but it is far less traditional and adherent to the rules of golf when compared to something like Mario Golf. It has elements of golf, platforming, action, puzzles. It's really a unique creation that goes far beyond what you would expect. Stages require you to defeat all enemies, and the final enemy will unlock a hole that you need to knock Kirby into. You don't control Kirby directly through traditional methods, instead hitting him to send him bouncing throughout the course. And yeah, he is bouncy. Perhaps the bounciest he's ever been. I think 90% of the frustration from this title is solely rooted in Kirby just bouncing out or on the edge of the hole instead of going in. If you've played an old-school golf game, the input method will look familiar. There are horizontal and vertical lines that let you determine what part of the ball to strike, as well as a power bar that determines distance. There's also a range meter that lets you put Kirby in the direction you want. In a lot of NES and SNES golf games, you really just need to hit the ball in the middle. But here, knowing how to spin Kirby is incredibly important. You might have to sacrifice distance for height so Kirby can clear obstacles, or spin him in the right way to avoid spikes. Knowing exactly how to hit Kirby, that sounds weird to say out loud, but knowing how to manipulate Kirby is the most important element of this game. It can be pretty frustrating at first, since Kirby likely won't go where you want him to, since he would just bounce around, completely missing an enemy or objective. A lot of it does feel like trial and error, but once you understand all the different types of shots and how to make Kirby go a specific way, it can be very engaging. But you will be banging your head against a wall for the first few stages, since Kirby seemingly never stops or goes where you want him to. The game could have easily fallen into a trap that would almost ruin the game. In golf, you hit the ball, and then you just watch the ball go. But thankfully in Dream Course, Hal realized, hey, no one just wants to watch Kirby bounce around. Let's give the players some agency. While it is not as direct as controlling Kirby in a platformer, you can do quite a bit once you've launched him. By pressing A, you can make him roll farther or bounce higher, or clear specific obstacles by timing your button presses. You can also gain special powers and copy abilities during the course that you can use. These interactive features prevent the game from being stale or relying too much on the initial shot. Although that is important, you do have some degree of freedom once you start flying around, so you can sort of save your shot if you didn't nail it just right. The courses are filled with a variety of obstacles and challenges. Enemies, trampolines, warp areas. There's a good progression of creative layouts as you move throughout the worlds. The isometric view makes it look like mini dioramas. I would love some Dream Course diorama figurines. If they run out of ideas for amiibos, here you go. Back to the copy abilities, they are your familiar powers, and how they're utilized is pretty different. For example, the Spark ability is used specifically to defeat Wispy Woods obstacles. Stone and Needle let you come to a complete stop, helping you set up your next shot. Perhaps my favorite is the Tornado, which lets you just fly around the stage and gain a ton of ground. You sort of have to relearn copy abilities, even if you're a Kirby veteran, since they operate pretty differently here. But that's also part of the fun, to see how they've taken these classic powers and made them fit into golf. The game can be pretty difficult, perhaps more so than most Kirby games. Understanding the physics and how to utilize powers correctly definitely takes some practice. Early on, Kirby will be flying out of bounds, or maybe you get a copy power but you're not quite sure how to properly use it within the stage. Most Kirby games give you a good deal of freedom in terms of how you complete it. You can clear any stage with any power, but here the abilities are tools for puzzle solving, along with your other techniques. You gotta go into the game knowing that it's mostly a puzzle game with action elements. You need to spend some time planning out your course and carefully thinking about how you're going to move around the map. Dream Course also has a multiplayer versus mode, which is a bit unorthodox for the franchise. The multiplayer courses are exclusive to that mode, and you win by collecting the most stars. I only dabbled in it a bit, but Dream Course is a unique game, so it goes without saying that the two-player mode is also very different from most multiplayer offerings. Worth noting that the second player controls a yellow Kirby, which apparently has the official name Kibi. I immediately thought, are all yellow Kirbys called Kibis? But no, apparently it is just this one specific yellow Kirby. And although yellow Kirbys appear again, they aren't Kibi. Kibi is only in Dream Course. Bring back Nago, bring back Kibi. I want to say that Dream Course is a weird spinoff, but nearly all the Kirby spinoffs are wonderfully weird. Like, is Dream Course any stranger than Tilt and Tumble or Canvas Curse? Is Canvas Curse even a spinoff? Who knows? But there's really not a game like Dream Course. There are some silly golf games out there like Ribbit King, But Dream Course doesn't feel dated at all because its mechanics haven't really been duplicated. Also, note to self, talk about Ribbit King in a future episode. Again, like Dream Land 3, this game is available on the SNES app of Nintendo Switch Online. If you're paying for that thing, take a break from playing Donkey Kong Country or whatever and knock out a few holes in Kirby Kinda Golf. Also, I want to note that Nintendo has PDFs of the original instruction booklets for many of the games on NSO, including Kirby's Dream Course. It's filled with a ton of awesome art. Remember when they would create new illustrations solely to show how the characters move and attack? We'll never get those back, will we? There's also a lot of Kibi art, suspiciously in many of the same poses as Kirby. But I'm sure they drew him from scratch each time. Let's stay on this Kirby train and go right into the episode's feature about Yamashiroya, an amazing toy shop in Tokyo with exclusive Kirby merch. This episode's feature is all about Yamashiroya, an expansive toy shop right outside of Ueno Station with dozens of unique Kirby items. I want to say it's hard to miss, even though it is a multi-floor toy store, but Ueno has so many points of interest, so many things that automatically catch your eye when you step out of the station, I think a lot of people bypass it, despite it being visible from the station. When you exit, you are likely darting right to the beautiful Ueno Park, with the sakura trees, or the lively market street, Ameyokocho, to grab lunch or dinner, or the many department stores in the area like Maruichi or Yodobashi Camera, or even the Starbucks right outside the station. There is a Starbucks inside of Ueno Park, but that gets crowded, so get your fix here. And yeah, if you're not into toys, you likely won't give Yamashiroya a second look. Now, I am not a toy boy myself. I have some amiibos, of course, and some stuff I've won from claw catchers and gashapons. Space is at a premium in Japan, so I vastly prefer paying 200 yen or so to get a small figure from a gashapon that can fit in the palm of my hand versus spending 5,000 yen to get something that needs its own shelf. But even if you're not into toys or figurines, I think Yamashiroya still has a lot to offer in terms of the sheer amount of items they have. It's simply just fun to walk through. You don't need to buy anything, but don't be surprised if you go in thinking you won't spend any money only to walk out with something like a Pac-Man bath bomb or a PlayStation hoodie. Let's look at a bit of history. When do you think Yamashiroya was founded? The 2000s, 90s, 80s? If you said 80s, you're right, but I bet you didn't guess 1880s. Yamashiroya started off as not a toy store, but an inn in 1882. That predates even Nintendo. Yamashiroya literally translates to mountain castle room, so that definitely suits an inn more than a toy store. Also, there aren't really any mountains in Ueno, but hey, that's a good name for a hotel regardless. It was destroyed in the Great Kanto earthquake in the early 1900s, and again during the Tokyo firebombings, but after the war, they started to sell toys. The current building opened up in 1971, and the name has changed from kanji to katakana. Toys are all about being new, being fresh, innovative, so the katakana branding suits it more than the traditional kanji. Tokyo has its share of notable toy stores. Hakuhinkan in Ginza is another famous one, known for their high quality and very expensive stuffed animals. Also, places like Big Camera and Yodobashi Camera have massive sections of the store solely dedicated to toys. So how does Yamashiroya stand out? Well, it has an incredible amount of variety, exclusive items, and nearly an entire floor dedicated to the one and only Kirby. It's easy to spot right outside of Ueno Station. It has a bright yellow logo with Yamashiroya spelled out in English, and a big blue UFO mascot. The front entrance is covered with ads of the newest toys, and there is almost always a big Pokemon mural. The entrance is flanked by dozens of gacha machines that wrap around the corner, so you don't even need to enter the store to start shopping. Even the vending machines next to the store typically have some sort of toy-themed skin. They were decked out in Sumiko Garashi characters last time I went. When you hop into the store, the real shopping adventure begins. Each floor has its own theme. They often move the entire floor. All the game stuff might be on the fifth floor, only for it to be moved to the third floor the next time you visit. So if you visit there and it's not exactly where I said, sorry. They do have the current layout on their official website, so check it out before you go. When you enter, you'll immediately notice it's not laid out like a typical toy store. I think many of us think these very long aisles, like in Toys R Us or Target. Even in Japan, Department stores with toy sections do have these long rows of toys, but since space is much more limited here, they use every inch. There are more mini aisles, open areas, and a liberal use of wall shelves. The shop is smartly laid out, and outside the first floor, it doesn't feel cramped. It's not like other Japanese shops where you need to shimmy down aisles that are made only for one person at a time. The first floor is known as Trend Toys. These are a mix of random items like new toys, pop-up shops, and more souvenir-oriented gifts. It's a good place to pick up things you're going to give to people who are not in Japan. Two of the standouts on this floor are the blind box minifigures and the large stickers. Japan has a ton of blind box toys that are typically part of a set. If you get all of them, they make a little scene. There are many Pokemon and Kirby-related ones, and I've definitely picked up a few. My favorite is maybe the Pokemon Tea Ceremony set, where I got some Tea Ceremony items themed around the starter Pokemon. There are really like a million Kirby blind boxes. Kirby sleeping, Kirby eating chocolate, Kirby going to the movies. The company that handles these is called Remint, so check their site out if you want a preview of what you can buy. The stickers are large ones you'd likely slap on a laptop. A lot have original art from Japanese artists, although some are pretty gaudy. Though I guess that's kind of the point. The first floor also typically has a small pop-up shop. Right now, the pop-up shop is themed all around socks that look like trains. Train fandom in Japan is a whole other world. From the first floor, you can go up to the second or descend down into the B1 character goods shop. B1 has a lot of items from Disney and Studio Ghibli. Dongori Kyowa Koku is Ghibli's official merch shop chain in Japan, so many of the items you see here will be there as well. A lot of Sanrio stuff is here too. Honestly, this floor is not really geared to me, so I typically hike up to floor 2, which houses both anime and international toys. By international, I mean America. I'm not quite sure why you would put anime and American franchises together, but hey, I'm sure they had to Tetris these toy racks to fit everything in there. The anime stuff here is mostly popular franchises you'd see in Shonen Jump. It's not really focused on expensive figurines, though. You need to go to Akihabara for that. But everything else is here. There's a lot of American toys here too, but at a much higher price than in the States. As a visitor from America coming to Japan, it likely won't be that interesting, but it is fun to see what they carry. There's a ton of Marvel stuff, a lot of Star Wars, including those cool samurai figures, and even a ton of Simpsons merch. A lot of horror monsters are also here, Freddy Krueger, Annabelle, and so on. This floor also has a ton of adult-aimed soft vinyl brands like Medicom, Pop Mart, Great Brain, and everything in between. The coolest thing from the Medicom line are the Mario and Zelda figures that replicate the box art. Like the Super Mario World toy has Mario riding Yoshi exactly like it looks like on the box. Weird, long Yoshi and everything. I own the Mario and Luigi figures based on the original Mario Brothers art, where Mario has this goofy pink and blue outfit. These are only about 10 bucks each, and they are great quality. Alright, I've been talking a lot about things that are only vaguely game-related. But floor 3. This is the main event if you love video games. Again, this floor has another odd combo. Video games and puzzles. I guess completing a jigsaw puzzle is kind of like a game. But forget about that, because your eyes are likely feasting on all the game merch. I wouldn't say it's comprehensive in the sense that you can buy something from every franchise, but a lot of Japan's most popular gaming franchises are here. And most importantly, Kirby. There is no dedicated Kirby shop in Japan, but this is the closest thing. There seems to be a pretty deep history between Kirby and Yamashiroya, but I can't figure out when it started. I first became aware of it in 2018 when there was a massive Kirby exhibition in Yamashiroya. Jumping ahead a bit, but the sixth floor of the toy shop is an exhibition hall that rotates out, and a few years ago, they had one dedicated to our favorite pink hero. The one in 2018 was an art exhibit showcasing artwork from throughout the series' history and something called Watto's Toy Shop. I have to assume Watto comes from Watto D. His Japanese name is Wadoru D. The entire floor was converted into a Kirby-themed toy shop. Imagine if a toy store was in a Kirby game. It would look like this. You might think, does Kirby have enough merch to warrant an entire floor? The answer is yes. Yes, he does. You would not believe the sheer amount and variety of Kirby merchandise in Japan. I could do an entire feature solely on the different pieces of Kirby merch I've seen. Outside of the merchandising monster that is Pokemon, Kirby is the most merch-heavy Nintendo franchise in Japan. There is definitely more Kirby merch than Mario merch. It might be closer than I think, but I do have to believe that in terms of the sheer number of unique items that were made, say, last year, Kirby definitely tops Mario. I can't give a definitive answer as to why, but I have some theories. Obviously, Kirby is a popular franchise in Japan. The games typically sell well here, and Kirby and the Forgotten Land recently had the highest opening week. I also think HAL and Nintendo have been very smart in terms of their marketing deals, licensing out Kirby to experienced toy makers who rely on making a lot of different types of merch, like plushies and blind boxes. Kirby is also an inherently perfect life form to turn into a plushie. I mean, he's round. If you walk into any Clawcatcher arcade in Japan, there will absolutely be some Kirby goods. I also think there is a collector mentality amongst Kirby fans. Anecdotal, but a lot of Japanese Kirby fans I follow on Twitter have huge collections and like to show it off. I'm not sure if this is a chicken and egg thing. Maybe they have huge collections because there is so much merch, or maybe there is so much merch because people have huge collections. But either way, there is a demand for Kirby goods in Japan, and Yamashiroya is there to meet this demand. Back to Wado's Toy Shop. It was originally a special exhibit, but it has been folded into the main store on the third floor. Even though it doesn't cover the entire floor, it still takes up a big amount of space and has dozens of unique items. They might change this by the time any of you visit, but currently there's a huge display celebrating Wado D's birthday, with a ton of figures behind glass. The standout, of course, being the giant gold Wado D. Sadly, not for sale. A fun thing about this section is that it's not just shelves of merch. It does look like a mini toy shop. There are Kirby-shaped balloons hanging from the ceiling, a shelf of flowers with Kirby plushies, and a lot of signage that makes you feel like you have entered a store within a store. Breaking down every single piece of merch here will be tough, but I'll try to give some highlights of my favorites. Obviously, the plushies are likely the first thing you'll notice. There are shelves and shelves of plushies of your favorite Kirby characters. Kirby, Wado D, Meta Knight, King Dedede, Marx, Magalore, and so much more. Okay, I have never understood why villains have so much merch. Why does Marx have a plushie? He tried to bring the galaxy to its knees and is some sort of abomination beyond the stars. But no, he's just sitting on the shelf innocently, as if he's done nothing wrong. This will always be my pet peeve. He should be in jail. The plushies have a lot of sizes. You can clip a small one to your bag, or buy a giant one and make it the centerpiece of your home. There are often some different themes, like pastel versions, or denim versions, or fluffy versions. One of my favorites is a plushie that looks kind of like a toy with stitching. I don't know how to explain this, but it's more of a stylized version of Kirby that looks like a plush you would see in the game instead of just turning Kirby into a plushie. It has more of an old school look. These were exclusive to Wado's Toy Shop, and I'm not sure if they sell them anymore, so grab it if you come across one. Yamashiroya does have quite a bit of exclusive items. I got a huge pin badge that was only sold there that's shaped like a star, showing completely unique Kirby art. One of the more recent and popular items is a Kirby version of One Night Werewolf, the popular party game. Werewolf is, or at least was, quite popular in Japan, and there are many variations. The Kirby version has pixel art on the cards and Kirby-exclusive roles and rules. I haven't tried it out yet, but it is a tempting purchase. The card design alone looks very nice. There are plenty of weird, strange items here too. There's a Kirby frying pan so you can make Kirby pancakes. I have no idea how accurate this thing is, but you can at least get a pink Kirby skillet. Another special item are the Kirby Hanafuda cards. I own a couple sets of Hanafuda cards, the traditional designs, and Mario. A set of Hanafuda cards is a bit more pricey than you would expect, so I've held off on the Kirby ones. There are also many Kirby automatones, which is an electronic instrument. If you've never seen this, it looks like a music note, and you play it by squeezing the round part that looks like a mouth on the bottom, and then moving your fingers along the long part. Kirby is round, so of course, he fits perfectly. I was surprised to see it available in different sizes, so you could make a whole band full of Kirby instruments. Wado's Toy Shop also has a section filled with manga, books, and CDs. A bookshop inside a shop, inside another shop. Kirby has had a lot of manga throughout the years. I kind of like the older ones where they hadn't really nailed down Kirby's look, so he looks like a ridiculous kid's drawing instead of the personification of roundness. There's quite a bit of variety of books here. One of the coolest is kind of a Where's Waldo of Kirby. Pages are filled with hundreds of Kirbys, and you have to find specific ones. Pretty easy to solve, but the art is really nice. You can also find some more traditional children's books. Think Rosalina's book from Super Mario Galaxy, though probably less sad. CDs are pretty much done for in the West, but they are still somewhat of a market in Japan. Yamashiroya carries soundtracks from the games and special OSTs like the Kirby Cafe. By the way, I thought about including the Kirby Cafe feature in this episode, but that alone is pretty big, so I'll feature it down the line. You gotta save something for later, although I know Kirby likes to eat everything at once. What else? There's a lot of folders, clear files, and other stationery items here. Japan is the king of stationery, but sadly I don't have many opportunities to use it. We gotta get rid of these computer things and go back to paper. There's also a pretty large section dedicated to eraser capsules. I'm not quite sure if that's the official name of what this is, but you pick a small plastic capsule and then fill it with mini erasers. These erasers are different versions of Kirby, items, enemies, you name it. Shove as many as you can into the capsule, then close it off and pay one price at the counter. I have a Mario version of this, and I've seen some Pokemon and Animal Crossing versions too. Other Kirby-branded items, there are jigsaw puzzles, and a lot of Kirby blind boxes are here, although you can find some on the first floor too. One of the cooler items are the Kirby terrariums, which kind of look like big snow globes with Kirby dioramas inside. It's called Terrarium Collection Super DX. Look it up and marvel at the cuteness. Various Kirby Gashapon and Claw Catchers are also on the edges of the shop, so if you want to take a risk, you can do it. I've had some pretty good luck with Kirby when it comes to Claw Catchers, though. The small ones are easier than the big ones, and since Kirby is round, his weight is distributed fairly evenly, making it easier to pick up. I have about 4 Kirbys I've won from Claw Catchers in my home, and I'll definitely have a few more before the year is up. That's basically it for the Kirby section. There's a bunch of other items I've skipped over, but they rotate their inventory out pretty frequently, so there's always something new to buy. Floor 3 is also home to merch from other gaming franchises. The floor is broken up into Nintendo franchises, Square, Capcom, mobile games, and new popular games. There's a smattering of other stuff here too, like Sonic is in there. Last time I went there, I immediately saw a huge shelf of Among Us merch, which was fairly popular in Japan. The Square area is pretty interesting as it mostly focuses on Final Fantasy, but there are some other franchises that pop up here too, like Nier or even Xenogears. I always found Square products to be really overpriced though. They consider their merch to be kind of premium items, but I think that shuts off people from casually picking something up. Dragon Quest, however, has its own big section. It's right next to Waddle's Toy Shop, and while it's not as big as Waddle's Toy Shop, it's almost as big. A ton of plastic figures, plushies, and general slime-related paraphernalia. I love the slime-shaped cups and the tea set. The King Slime is the teapot. How genius is that? Capcom really only has Monster Hunter figures and plushies. You need to go to the Capcom store in Parco Shibuya to find more. I talked about it in a previous episode, so check that out if you haven't yet. For mobile games, I've seen some goods from Granblue Fantasy and Monster Strike. I know mobile games are incredibly popular, but I still think it's weird to see merch for phone games. For Nintendo, there's obviously the typical Mario, Splatoon, and Pokemon stuff. Though if you want Pokemon merch, the Pokemon Center is where it's at. Nintendo Tokyo has pretty much overtaken the shop in terms of Nintendo merch, but it is still the place to go for Kirby items. Floor 4 is labeled Kids Toys. Hey, what have we been looking at this whole time? But these are toys aimed solely at kids and not just collectors. Your Kamen Rider and Precure stuff is here, but they also have some Tamagotchi, so it's worth looking at if you're into virtual pets. Floor 5 has a lot of plastic model building, equipment, and this is where you'll find your Gundams. There's also a lot of Godzilla merch and a bunch of animal toys. Is Godzilla an animal? I think he is technically one, right? Some game stuff is here too, though, like Undertale, Hollow Knight, Apex, and PlayStation-focused goods. A lot of the merch based on Western games are from Fangamer, so it's nothing you haven't seen before if you live in the West. The PlayStation area does have some Japan-only items, including a great-looking Ape Escape shirt. Hey Sony, bringing that franchise back. Floor 6 is the exhibition hall, and this could vary wildly. I mentioned the Kirby events beforehand, and I've seen some things like model trains, stuffed animals, creatures that started off as line stickers or whatever. It's hit and miss depending on your interest. So, that's Yamashiroya. If you're a Kirby fan, it is absolutely a must visit when you go to Tokyo. It is right in the middle of a major tourist area, so you don't need to go out of your way to find it. You could easily come to Ueno for the park and Ameyokucho and still have time to swing by the shop to pick up some merch. Even if you haven't bought a toy in 20 years, it's still fun to peruse and see all the amazing and creative merch they carry. News time. Let's just get it out of the way. The sequel to The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. Breath of the Wild 2. To Breath, Too Wild. Remember when I kept saying it was definitely coming out this year? Well, turns out I may have been a bit mistaken. Nintendo recently announced that Breath of the Wild 2 is no longer a 2022 title, but will instead release in spring 2023. So about a year from now. I've already screamed into a bag, so it's out of my system. But we might as well touch on it. Nintendo was pretty adamant about it coming out in 2022, and I thought so too. A lot of people were rightfully skeptical, but I thought, nah, it's been 3 years since the announcement. It's coming much more sooner than later. Nintendo announced it on Twitter with a fresh-looking Aonuma standing in front of an ominous black background with the title, An Update to the Launch Timing of the Sequel to Breath of the Wild. I mean, that picture alone told us everything. One bright spot is that we did get some new Zelda footage. About 2 seconds of it. We get a brief shot of Link looking at a corroded Master Sword with a gnarly hand. Okay, a few things to touch on. In the trailer from last year, they never clearly showed Link's face when he was wearing the green robe, so some speculated that it might be a different character, or something might have been wrong or different with Link's face. But nope, it just looks like Link. This is the closest we've seen the hand, and it does look like either Ganondorf's hand or the same one as the creepy ghost. Last year's trailer showed that this is basically our replacement for the slate, and it seems to have a heavy story significance. The messed up Master Sword is by far the most interesting element. In the previous game, the Master Sword did break, but recharged to max after 10 minutes. It also had the unique ability of doubling in power once you were in dungeons. But here it looks pretty unusable. I assume some part of the plot will revolve around you repairing the sword. The quest to get the Master Sword was one of my favorites in the first game, so I'm curious to see how they live up to that here. A decayed sword does sort of hint that weapon durability will be back in some form. I thought it was implemented masterfully in the first game, though I am aware that many dislike it. And I'm sure Nintendo is aware of this too. Even though I thought it was near perfect the first time around, Nintendo will make some adjustments to the system. Purely a guess, but I think weapon crafting and combinations will be a gameplay feature. Like when your weapon breaks, you will get shards to craft something new, or maybe distinct pieces of a weapon, like a hilt or a gem that you can combine into a completely new weapon. In the trailer last year, we saw Link with a shield and something attached to it, so modifying equipment seems feasible. Letting players kind of make their own weapons and gear does tie in with the freedom the game strives to provide. Of course, I am disappointed with the delay. It was my most anticipated game this year, but if Nintendo feels like they need to delay it, I'm sure they have a good reason. And I don't think this hurts Nintendo's 2022 at all. Especially since they sort of out of nowhere announced Pokemon Gen 9 for this holiday, which is a Zelda tier announcement in my mind. We might get some Zelda thing this year though, like Wind Waker or Twilight Princess remasters. Or maybe Grezzo has something they're working on. Let's go back to Kirby for a bit. I mentioned last episode that Kirby will have a 30th anniversary concert this August. Merch is starting to hit, and you can pre-order plushies, shirts, and keychains all themed around the concert now. The most important item being the Kirby Concert Towel. Concert towels are a major thing in Japan. Basically, it's just a rectangular towel that has the name of the band or performer that you, well, just hold up during the concert. If you've played a Splatfest in Splatoon 2, you've seen something like this. I've also seen these towels at sumo tournaments, so it's kind of funny just to see people holding up towels of a sumo wrestler's name. And if you need even more Kirby, there are currently two collaborations happening in Japan. Boss Coffee and Moss Burger both have Kirby campaigns going on right now. Boss Coffee has some awesome animated commercials with Kirby and friends, a lot centered around the concert too. Kirby is not actually on any of the bottles or anything, which sort of makes sense because, well, kids don't drink coffee. Though why even have this campaign in the first place? In Japan, Tommy Lee Jones is the spokesman for Boss Coffee, so now he and Kirby have something in common. Mos Burger is celebrating their 50th anniversary this year, so they've got quite a few decades on Kirby. But they're partying together in their latest collab, where you can get special anniversary plates and toys. Kirby actually shows up at Mos Burger quite a bit, so this is not a surprising collaboration. Although I'm not a Mos Burger fan at all, so I will skip this one. Last bit of Kirby news, the franchise can now add a Grammy to its accomplishments. The 8-Bit Big Band won a Grammy in the Best Arrangement, Instrumental, or Acapella category for their rendition of Meta Knight's Revenge from Kirby Superstar. It's a great remix, and it's available on YouTube, so check it out. Honestly, game music is long overdue for Grammys, so I think you probably have a good chance of winning a Grammy if you just remix an existing amazing game song. Do a slight remix of Time Scar, and that gold statue is yours. Nintendo announced the latest N64 game coming to NSO, Mario Golf. This is the original game from Camelot. I own it, but actually I've never played it. The Japanese box copy just sits on my shelf. Also, on the Japanese box, the strange English sentence, "For all players hoping to touch the true entertainment," wraps around the logo. I know a lot of people were expecting Kirby 64, but it sort of doesn't make sense to release that at the same time as a new Kirby title. Nintendo is sticking to this one N64 game per month schedule, but we will see if we get some disruptions. I'd love for some oddball picks to show up, like the N64 version of Animal Crossing or Doshin the Giant. So far, the Japanese N64 NSO has had almost perfect parity with the US app, but they have shown off Custom Robo, so that will show up eventually. Some new game announcements. Nobody Saves the World is coming to Nintendo Switch on April 14th. This hit PC and Xbox earlier this year and was highly praised. It's from Drinkbox Studios, who brought us Guacamelee and Severed. It's a top-down action game that emphasizes gaining new powers and changing your loadout. Kind of Kirby adjacent, maybe? Another indie game got a date. Pocky and Rocky Reshrined comes out on April 21st in Japan and June 24th in the West. It's a sequel to the Pocky and Rocky series, also known as Kiki Kai Kai in Japan. It's a directional shooter where you play as a shrine maiden and a tanuki. What more do you need in a game? Natsume Atari and developer Tingo Project are promoting this as a completely new title, although Reshrine kind of makes it sound like a remaster. It'll be 4,000 yen, but I'm wondering if the US price will be a bit cheaper. Sort of game-related, but Yoshitaka Amano, known for his amazing Final Fantasy art, currently has an exhibit in Tokyo titled The Coming of Spring. It features pieces from his Candy Girl series. The exhibit seems pretty small and doesn't feature any of his game work, but it's great to support artists you respect. The exhibit is close to Omotesando, so very doable for Tokyo residents. Let's close with some Japanese software and hardware sales. Kirby had a big opening, with Kirby and the Forgotten Land taking the top spot at 380,000 physical units the first week. This is the highest opening for a Kirby game ever in Japan, easily topping the previous champ, Kirby Superstar Ultra's 260,000 units. And keep in mind, that game only had physical units, while Forgotten Land also has an unknown number of digital sales. Week 2 saw Kirby at number 1 again, and it has sold 491,000 physical units. Pretty safe to say it's cleared at least a million or two worldwide, and if it keeps up this momentum, I can see it selling easily over 5 million copies and eventually becoming the best-selling Kirby title. Another big release, Ghostwire Tokyo, isn't faring quite as well, since it has about 12,000 physical units after 2 weeks. I want to play it though, because I heard it faithfully recreates Tokyo, and that's always fun to experience in game form. Software continues to be dominated by Nintendo Evergreens, and Arceus is still hanging around the top and has passed 2.2 million units physically. Mario Kart 8 got a big boost these past few weeks thanks to the DLC, and ironically, Zelda also popped up a few spots. I guess some people want to try the original now that the sequel is a bit a ways. Switch hardware continues to sell well, with about 150,000 units these past 2 weeks. It is trailing behind last year, though, since Monster Hunter Rise gave a massive boost to hardware. The conversation this year will be whether or not Switch hardware has reached a saturation point and will continue to go down year over year, despite still selling in droves and setting records. PS5 has been selling over 30,000 a week recently, likely thanks to stock improvements and Elden Ring and Gran Turismo 7. There aren't any Japan-focused big PS5 exclusives on the horizon, though, so these numbers could easily drop. In terms of sales, The story in April will be watching how far Kirby will go and what impact Nintendo Switch Sports has. Let's move on to the Japanese gaming phrase of the week. This episode's phrase is Ishoku. Ishoku. It literally means transplant. Can you guess what this means in the gaming sphere? That's right. It's essentially the Japanese word for port. Ishoku is when a game is transplanted to another piece of hardware or ported. This can apply to remakes or remasters, though I suppose some people call those ports as well. Unlike a lot of past gaming phrases, there is an analogous English term, but I thought it was interesting that the term Ishoku in Japanese has more of a biological, more of a surgical use than the English word. It's like you are literally cutting off a piece of flesh from a game console and grafting it onto another one. Ew. Once again, Ishoku. Now for the Japanese tweet of the week. I've chosen one from @goegoes, a retro game fan. It's a brief out-of-context video of Pac-Man Manju, which is a traditional Japanese snack. It's kind of like a soft bread filled with anko, or red bean. The video just shows a shelf full of snacks shaped like Pac-Man and the ghost. If I saw it today, I would absolutely buy it. It's priced at 680 yen, and man, those are not 2022 prices for an entire box of souvenir snacks. As always, the tweet is in the podcast description. Split into three and do a dance because we've reached the goal line for this episode. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends or on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be Sunday, April 24th. See you next time. Mata ne!